From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
The ayes have it, and Mike Madigan is once again reelected chairman of the Democratic Party of Illinois. Speaker Madigan.
If the amount of money spent on negative advertising against me has been spent against you, your poll numbers would be in bad shape, too.
Lift your head and hold it high!
Lift your head and hold it high!
Illinois gun owners marching by!
Illinois gun owners marching by!
Be aware of those commercial entities that want to jump into the political arena and attack the NRA and attack you as gun owners. I say screw Yeti. I say screw Dick's Sporting Goods. They don't need my money, and they don't need yours. Remember it on how you spend.
McCann is being used as a pawn by Pritzker and Madigan. We're going to win in November.
So he poses no threat despite the fact that he's basically appealing to the same core Republican conservative base that Jimmy Ives did and narrowly losing to you.
McCann is a pawn. He's being used by Pritzker and Madigan, and we're going to win in November.
Governor Bruce Rauner is back from his overseas trade mission. He pulled no punches talking about Sam McCann, the Republican senator turned third-party candidate who plans to challenge for the governor's office. Also this week, Michael Madigan, longtime House Speaker, winning another term as state Democratic Party chair. And what is next when it comes to the issue of guns in Illinois? An effort to have state licensing of gun dealers stalled this week. We'll talk about that and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Joining me in studio today, Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter. In our State House Bureau today, Daisy Contreras, IPR reporter, and John O'Connor of the Associated Press. And John, it's good to have you on once again.
Glad to be back, Sean.
Daisy, let me start with you. I know you were at the Democratic Party chair vote that took place this week. There was some people wondering a few weeks back if Michael Madigan would be able to hang on to that position. He was voted, though, winning pretty handily for his sixth consecutive term as the Democratic Party chair. He was talking there about poll numbers, his own poll numbers. He's, you know, most of these polls showing he's not the most popular politician in the state. What did he have to say? What was that all about?
Well, despite those numbers, Sean, he was still able to get that sixth term as chairman, and something he's had since 1998. Now, he wasn't able to get one vote out of the 36. Peter Janko, he's the State Central Committee man from the 14th Congressional District. He stands behind progressive ideas, livable minimum wage, tuition-free community college. He says he supports Michael Madigan as a leader, but he doesn't think the party has evolved enough to be more inclusive of other Democrats who stand in support of these ideas that he stands behind. He said he had a good working lunch with Madigan, and he hopes he got his concerns across. So that's one of the many things that Madigan kind of touched upon that day.
Well, of course, I was going to say, of course, you can work with people and you may not always like them, present company excluded here, of course, but there is that situation. And in politics, that happens a lot. Was it one big happy family after this vote, or could you tell?
I noticed that some of the members present there noted that they wanted to see more change. So it wasn't that they were completely happy with that. They made sure to tell Madigan that we need change, especially with the whole issue of sexual harassment issues that happened in Madigan's staff earlier this year. They want more change in that aspect as well, and to just be more inclusive and include issues, progressive issues that other Democrats stand behind.
Yeah, and I would second what Daisy said. You could feel that from some of the members, like when Congresswoman, I think it was Robin Kelly, got up there and she seconded the nomination for Speaker Madigan. And she began by saying, you know, I was kind of surprised when the Speaker called me and asked me to nominate him, but here I am, okay. And, you know, she it was not the sort of, you know, rousing, this is my leader, I want to stand behind him kind of thing. It was, yeah, okay, let's do this again, seemed to be more of the attitude. You know, and then, of course, later this week, the State Journal Register had an editorial here in Springfield sort of attacking Democrats. Why did they do this? What are they thinking? But it really is a rational choice on their part, right? Speaker Madigan, he's still the most powerful person in the House of Representatives. He still controls a lot of the campaign money that flows through Illinois. And frankly, his track record speaks for itself. He still wins, and people like to be associated with a winner. And he pointed out that, the Democrats who campaigned against Speaker Madigan lost their primaries, at least the candidates who are running for governors, and the one who stood by him, J.B. Pritzker, won.
I think if I were a Democrat, particularly in a tough race, and under pressure to denounce Madigan, I'd say, sorry, he's a winner. I'm going with him.
Now, Charlie, when we talk about the sexual harassment scandals and the Democratic Party operation that have come under Madigan's watch, and he's been criticized for some of that and how those have been handled, has he weathered that storm?
Well, apparently he has, at least with the Central Committee men and Central Committee women. And if I'm not mistaken, he also announced at the time that all Democratic campaign workers, volunteers were going to undergo sexual harassment training. Didn't he say that at the time, Daisy and Brian?
Yes, he did.
Yes, he did.
And so to me, this is a response to these concerns. And he's shown the ability over the years to adjust his positions to what he thinks would be most advantageous for his goal. And his goal has always been to elect Democrats.
Well, John, you weighed in there for a moment ago, but let me ask you this. When it comes to Bruce Rauner, and of course he and Madigan have really gone head-to-head here in a lot of infighting over the past, in government over the past couple of years, does this give Rauner some type of sounding board as he moves forward in this race for governor by having Madigan in this position still to basically say Democrats are not ready to make a change?
Well, Bruce Rauner's got a lot bigger problems since March 20th than Mike Madigan. I think whatever leverage he had gained against Madigan, he lost when he lost the income tax fight a year ago. He can continue to blame Mike Madigan, but at the same time, while at the same time he's balancing the budget on Mike Madigan's tax increase. Going forward, he needs to shore up his base, and I don't think the attacks against Madigan are gonna do much for him, because while there was no budget, he could blame Madigan. Now there's a budget, I think people just grew tired of there being no budget. But he could, while there was no budget, he could blame Madigan. He can't do that anymore. He's got a run on his record, and people are waiting to see what he comes forward with as his record.
And as for Madigan, I think that
too is that a lot of the governor's campaign so far has been anti-Madigan. Now, had the Democrats deposed Madigan and put someone else in as the head of the party, that might undercut Rauner's number one campaign message.
I would add to that, Madigan seems that he is actually trying to show that he knows that change needs to happen, and he's open to embracing that change. Just yesterday, Madigan introduced a resolution in the House in support of a progressive state income tax. So he's definitely trying to bring that unity and attract the progressive Bernie Sanders base.
And Daisy, that was also something that J.B. Pritzker is now saying he favors, is the graduated income tax. And, of course, Daniel Biss was considered maybe the most progressive of all candidates in the race for governor. Of course, he was pushing for this as well. So it is sort of an olive branch there.
Right. And it seems to be working for their message, at least.
Yeah, I would just add, we've said it before on this program, and I think it bears repeating now. I think the speaker, one of the things he's really good at is being a weather vane. He knows where the wind's blowing. So in the 80s, when it was Reagan Democrats and the party was tending more conservative, he fostered that. And now he has you know, he's moving in a more progressive direction, if you will, on this graduated income tax and things like that. This is a Catholic, pro-life, personally person, but he has allowed abortion measures to pass. He supported or allowed same-sex marriage to pass. Those are not things that you would expect from somebody who is, you know, personally conservative, but he cares about electing Democrats. That is his main thing. And if that means that you're going to have an anti-abortion Democrat, fine, as long as they're a Democrat. If you're a pro-gun Democrat, fine, as long as you're a Democrat. And I think we're seeing evidence of that again and continuously. I mean, he is, and this is why I think people support him and why the Democrats have done so well, because they are a big tent party. They welcome people of differing ideas as long as you're a Democrat from their point of view.
Charlie, before we move along, speaking of the graduated income tax, you wrote a column this week for Illinois Issues. Why don't you give us the point you were trying to make with that?
Well, I think the point I was trying to make is that were I advising the Democratic nominee, J.B. Pritzker, I would tell him, lay out the specifics of what you want to do. Tell people, here are the brackets, here are the income levels, here are the rates, here are the exemptions, here are the deductions, so people can calculate whether or not they would be better off under Pritzker's plan than under the current flat rate plan.
And Charlie, just to interrupt you a minute, Pritzker has not done that so far. No, he's not laid out numbers.
Unless he's doing it as we speak, he has not. And that opens him up to the notion that the Republicans have been pushing is that everybody's taxes will go up. Well, that's not true in the sense that you really don't know until you look at what the details are. Just for the heck of it, I went to the Department of Revenue or the akin agency in our neighboring states, and I looked up their income tax forms, and I calculated what the income tax would be. Would it be higher or lower for someone with a median Illinois household income in Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, Kentucky? And I found out that you would pay less in Missouri, a lot less. You would pay less in Wisconsin. You'd pay more in Kentucky. You'd pay more, pretty much more, in Iowa. So you really can't say, is this going to cost more or less until you see the details? And while the details aren't out there, that allows the opponents to say, oh, everybody's taxes will go up.
All right. And then while we're also talking politics here, Brian, Bruce Rauner came back, as we mentioned at the start of the show, from this trade mission he'd been on for a couple of weeks, actually, in Europe. And one of the things he got hit with immediately was, hey, Sam McCann is running for governor as a third-party candidate. He doesn't like Sam McCann. Feeling appears to be mutual. What did Rauner have to say?
Yeah, well, we heard it pretty much all he had to say at the top of the show, which is that he contends that McCann is a tool of Pritzker and Madigan, and that he's going to win the election this fall. This idea that McCann is a tool of Pritzker and Madigan, I mean, Pritzker Madigan is basically the byword of the Rauner campaign. Everything you hear is going to be Pritzker Madigan this, Pritzker Madigan that. And by linking State Senator McCann in there, who has differed with the governor on labor issues, but is still fairly conservative on a lot of other issues. He was at the gun rally we'll talk about later this week. Make no mistake, this is not, I mean, he has worked with Democrats in the Illinois Senate here, but he is, I don't think he would consider himself a tool. However, he did take a big campaign contribution from one of the labor unions that is somewhat allied with Speaker Madigan. That is fairly closely allied with Speaker Madigan, I should say. So that's where Rauner can make that argument. We're talking about this. It's worth repeating here, as we have in the past, that Senator McCann has a long way to go before he can even get on the ballot, because I think he has to gather, 25,000 signatures, and they can't be people who voted in the primary. So,
hey Brian. Still,
yeah, go
I'm
ahead, Charlie.
I'm pretty sure I had said that in the past, and I think that was incorrect.
Thank you for clarifying.
No,
go ahead.
No, and I apologize for that, but you can't pass petitions for a new party if you voted in another party's primary, if you were involved in another primary.
So that still makes it difficult, though.
Sure, right.
Because the people who pass petitions, they're not just folks you find out on the street corner. Right.
Yeah, and apparently Rich Miller of Capital Facts has done reporting that Speaker Madigan's one of his top aides, his chief of staff in the House, went around pulling all of the petition passers, like literally everybody, this fall, which is kind of an unusual thing, and people were scratching their heads about it. But what you can do with that information is build a database of people who have passed petitions in the primary, and then know if you're going to have somebody circulate for one of these, you know, as a independent or third party candidate, you can knock them out. So it's a way of, you know, if McCann has access to that database, well, that does suggest some level of working together with the Democrats, or at least, you know, the Democrats looking favorably on his candidacy.
Well, we did get a report this week. John, you reported on this. It came from the Illinois Comptroller's Office, Susana Mendoza putting this out. It looked at how much interest the state has racked up when it comes to overdue bills. Give us the takeaway from that. It was a pretty shocking number.
Since mid-2015, which is the time at which the historic budget stalemate began. We had no budget because of disagreements between Republican Rauner and the Democrats who control the General Assembly for 2 years, but continued to spend at typical rates. Didn't have the revenue to pay those bills. Those bills become overdue, and state law indicates that in many cases, after 90 days, a bill that isn't paid starts gaining 1% per month interest. In those 2 years, 2.5 years since July of 2015, the late interest penalty is $1.14 billion with a B dollars, and that is more than the late interest fee built up on all late bills dating to 1998, from 1998 to 2015. That's pretty mind-boggling.
Well, just so I'm clear,
extra
John,
money that has to be paid.
Just so I'm clear on that, John, were we always paying the same interest for that period of time?
Yes.
Okay. So basically, Brian, this is definitely, you know, shows, I think, the magnitude of what Illinois has gotten itself into here. Is it getting any better, though? I mean, we passed this tax increase. It sounds like the backlog's coming down a little bit. They borrowed some money. So is this actually getting better?
I mean, it is getting better in that the backlog is now, you know, some might argue we've stopped the bleeding. We've stopped some of the bleeding, you could say, because, like you said, we borrowed money that's at a lower interest rate, you know, from the bond market at, what was it, about 4.5% or something like that, as opposed to
3.5%, actually.
Okay, thank you, John. Yeah. As opposed to this, you know, 12% a year that on some of these bills. But, I mean, I would love to put that number that John cited, $1.1 billion, right? The State Department of Corrections running the entire prison system for a year is, at least in one recent year, was $1.3 billion. $1.1 billion is more than Illinois spends on the University of Illinois and many other public universities in a year. I mean, you just think about the opportunity cost that came from the budget impasse. It's something that we're going to be feeling the repercussions of for a long time to come.
And Charlie, this is, like Brian said, when you put it into that type of context, it really shows the magnitude of the problem here.
Oh, yeah. It's just, we wound up with a bill backlog that was roughly three times what it was at the end of fiscal year 2015. Now we've cut it down to half, largely, as was mentioned, because we sold bonds. We used a good portion of the proceeds of that bond sale to pay Medicaid bills, for which we get 50 cents back on the dollar from the federal government. So that generated additional revenue. Now we're kind of holding steady around $8 billion. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but we're much better off not having to pay maybe $500 million, $600 million in interest going forward.
Charlie, before I move off on this topic too, can you give us just kind of the historical view? I mean, do we ever get to the point where we're even anywhere close to this type of backlog? I mean, we know that the backlog's the record high, but I mean, what was it like before, say, 1998 and those times?
No, it was never this high.
And the payment cycle was much, much shorter from what I recall, too.
Yeah, the idea is that the late interest penalties don't kick in until, for some of the bills, after 90 days. And back in the day, we generally had things paid. there's always bills remaining to be paid, simply because when you buy something, particularly back before all the internet electronic stuff, you buy something, then you wait for the bill to come in, and then you pay it. So you always got bills there. But it was never the extent that we've seen in recent years.
John, before we move off of this, just so people understand of why this report was released now, or when, you know, what this came about because of some legislation that the state comptroller was able to put together and get passed, and that's how these numbers were compiled, correct?
Right. It was opposed by the Rauner administration, but she pushed and had bipartisan support in the General Assembly for a law to require that the state agencies that are held, they incur the bills, contract for vendor services, and they're billed. They need to send those bills to the controller. There is always a number of bills that have not been sent to the controller, and there was no way to tell how much was being held at the agencies at any given time, and so this law required monthly reporting by the state agencies of how much they're still holding in bills. So it gave the controller a better idea. She was able to calculate specifically how much the state actually owes at this moment, and how much the late fees are. Now, I will say the other thing that she determined from this report that was fairly well known or speculated upon was that the state also has $1 billion in spending, money that has gone out the door that has never been appropriated by the General Assembly, including some $400 million at the Department of Corrections. And those are bills that the Corrections Department hasn't sent to the controller because they don't have an appropriation to do it. So there's another $1 billion in the hole that is not being accounted for in the current budget or in the one for fiscal 19 that the governor has proposed.
Well, a few weeks back, we heard from some gun control activists in the wake of that Parkland, Florida school shooting. They came to the Capitol, and we've been hearing from a lot of folks who want to see certain changes when it comes to the state's gun laws. Well, gun owners got their turn to march on the Capitol this week. Daisy, they came at a time when a piece of legislation was facing a deadline, a veto override. If they were going to do it, it had to happen this week. That didn't happen, so they probably were pretty pleased with that. But fill us in on what took place this week when it comes to the issue of guns in Illinois.
Yeah, so just some background. Earlier this month, Governor Rauner vetoed legislation that passed out of the General Assembly. It would have required gun shops to pay up to $1,000 for a five-year license and then get employees some training to spot illegal gun purchasers. And since then, the sponsor, Senator Don Harmon, he's been trying to win votes in the Senate and really trying really hard to get votes in the House. And the deadline, like you said, was Wednesday this week. On the same day, gun owners got it together in Springfield for their annual gun owner lobby day. And at the end of the day, after a lot of speculation, if he was going to call the override vote, Harmon announced that he wouldn't be trying because he couldn't get enough support in the House. And he needed 36 votes in the Senate and 71 votes in the House. And that would have required some Republican support.
And he says he's not done with this issue, though. This could come back.
Right. So now what Harmon did, he piled on language from this bill onto an existing one to continue the conversation with suburban Republicans and get something passed.
Brian, you were at that. March this week. A couple of thousand people, at least there. It sounds like, and pretty fired up from what we'd heard earlier.
Yeah, the organizers claimed 2,500, which is they say about roughly double from what was there last year. That's down quite a bit. The biggest one I can remember was back, I think, in 2013 when Illinois had not yet passed concealed carry and was working on that. Organizers said they had more than 8,000 people that year. But yeah, quite a few. They did a rally at a convention center in downtown Springfield where people got up and spoke, and that's where we heard the clip at the beginning of the show. I think this is a moment because of the school shootings that gun owners feel particularly vulnerable. I guess that may sound strange to say it that way, but to legislation that they do not support because of the student protests that seem to have galvanized some public opinion. They feel besieged by the media. I heard several times, both once personally directed at me by a chanting crowd, and another time just more generally from the podium at these things, how they don't feel they are portrayed, and they don't like the way they're portrayed in the media. But they were still successful, at least in convincing the legislators not to move on this gun dealer override vote, and they say that they're going to keep up the pressure. We heard about a very concerted political strategy where they're going to be going and trying to, having people arrange meetings. This lobbying group will arrange meetings between gun owners and their legislators. And this is something we know. This is a group that it's a relatively small proportion of the population that holds these, views as one of the most important political issues, but they are very active and they definitely make their presence felt.
Well, it struck me that it was no surprise at all that the veto override did not occur. If you just look at the roll calls when the bill initially passed both chambers, it had 30 affirmative votes in the Senate, but there were 8 people who did not vote and who, at least in theory, would have been open to supporting an override. In the House, it passed with 64 affirmative votes, but there were only 2 House members who did not vote. So there were 52 who voted no. And one of the things that I saw over the years, that is once you take a position on a controversial issue, you're really not going to change it. Because when you took the position initially, the people on the other side are unhappy about it. When you change, the people who were with you before are now unhappy at you, and the people who didn't like you before still don't like you. So there was no way it was going to pass in the House, and Senator Harman figured rather than string out Senate Democrats in a lost cause, he would wait and battle another day. Now, Daisy, you can fill me in on this, but my understanding is that Senator Harman wants to tweak the legislation somewhat to answer to some of the objections from the business community, for example, that this would be a hardship for small business owners who have gun shops and would have to go through all this rigmarole of registering and security and all that.
Yeah, that's one of the concerns from small shop owners, that they wouldn't be able to afford this licensing fee. And yeah, definitely, Harman did say that he wants to be more open to changing what that final bill would look like.
All right, time now for our notes from the field. John O'Connor.
There's a letter from several healthcare organizations to key legislators asking that they take a real hard look at the way the rollout is occurring of moving 800,000 Medicaid clients to managed care organizations. The managed care organizations are coordinating care and focusing on prevention and trying to cut medical costs. But these organizations have a lot of concerns about the way it's being done and whether those MCOs will be able to connect clients with their doctors. And the legislators say, yeah, we're taking a hard look at that.
All right. Daisy?
Yes. So the Senate earlier this week approved legislation to outlaw the manufacture or possession of bump stocks or trigger cranks. These turn rifles into assault-style weapons, and it's the same device that the gunman used in the Las Vegas mass shooting last October. So now that piece of legislation moves on to the House.
All right, Brian.
Yeah, there was another interesting bill. Charlie made reference earlier to the committee men and committee women. That language would become obsolete if this bill passes. In terms of state politics, they would become committee persons under state law, and the term chairman would also be changed to chair. I guess I'm going to have to relearn what I learned from my AP style book many years ago.
All right. Well, members of our broadcast today included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and John O'Connor. Production assistance for the program provided by Brian Mackey. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.